And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everybody. This is Martin Willis, your host. We have a great show coming up for you this evening. Jesse Marcel III, he'll be talking, well, about his new project. It's called Airborne Motors. We're talking about a flying car, maybe a future UFO. And, of course, second hour, we'll be talking more about his past, his family, Roswell, and all that. And should be a great show. Before him, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the latest UFO events, and he's telling me there's a lot of stuff going on, so might be a little extra long news this evening. Don't forget, we have some new T-shirts available. The picture on our website does not do them justice. They're really nice-looking shirts, and if you just go to our website, it's podcastufo.com. You can see it right on the sidebar there, and we're using James Nathan's. It's called UFO Crash. And we have the rights to use that. It's a beautiful image. Check it out. And I am not able to get email or send email, I should say. I can get your email through a forwarder if you write me at martin@podcastufo. I have to use Gmail to respond. This server that I have, the new server I have, has been a real headache. And this is one of those headaches that just can't seem to be ironed out. So I want to thank everyone for their support. Through Joyride. It's been going very well. And if you have not subscribed yet and you want to hear the second hour of the podcast, go to getjoyride.com/podcastufo. The link is, again, right on our website. Subscribers pay only $1 a month or more to access the full two-hour show. And there's a private link in there for iTunes, and you can put it on your iPhone and all kinds of good stuff. And if you have any questions or problems, you can actually email them directly. They're very good about getting back to people. It's feedback@getjoyride.com. And if you can't help us out for $1 a month or more, we still appreciate every single listener. So that's it for me, and we're ready to start with the news. We got a lot going on again. And how you doing, Alejandro?
I'm doing pretty good. Busy, but doing very well. How about yourself?
Good. I got a two-day break from the snow, but it came back with vengeance. Good. I can barely see my house.
Ooh, yucky snow. Yeah. Luckily, there's none here. If you watched the Super Bowl, you saw the wonderful weather we're having here in Arizona.
Yeah. So I know we got a lot to cover, so let's roll right into it.
All right, yeah. Not only is the conference keeping me super busy, but lots of UFO news, a ton of it. So, of course, a lot of people probably saw that John Greenwald had to take down those Blue Book files that you and I have been speaking about so often. Some people have claimed that John Greenwald stole these files from Fold 3. Not true whatsoever. Those people, many of them know the truth, are just lying. I think some people have a personal grudge against John for whatever reason. But regardless, what happened is most of those files did come from a company called Fold 3, and it was a third party who downloaded all of those files and provided them to UFO researchers to post, and John Greenwald was able to turn them into PDFs and post them. But he also posted his personal files that he had received a Blue Book as well. However, Fold 3 came and said, due to the Digital Copyright Millennium Act, we own those and take them down. And it's kind of like a case of, you know, John Greenwald doesn't have the money to pay lawyers to fight them. So he, unfortunately, for now, now had to take those down. Many, many people are disappointed that Fold 3 is claiming digital copyright over documents that are open to the public. And so this is really frustrating. And I know there are a lot of people fighting this. And I have a feeling that we have not heard the end of this. And I don't think Fold 3 is going to win in the long run on this one.
Yeah. Yes, I've been getting some, you know, negative emails about this and contact. So, I'm just not even going to talk about it, and just we'll see what happens.
Oh, you wussy. Yeah, but let's...
Well, let me just tell you something. I've had a couple of weeks of grief because we've been talking about this.
Yeah, but you know what? There's a lot of trollers out there, and, you know, I've always felt I can't let these small minority of people stop me from bringing this information to the masses and the thousands of people who are dying for this information and love it. And no doubt the positive feedback has by far overwhelmed the negative feedback that is out there, even though those couple of negative people are very loud.
Yes. You know, the one thing I do say about this whole situation, and I may have said it before, is that I think it's just going to cause more people to have more awareness. And I don't think it's, you know, I don't good, bad, or indifferent. I think it's good publicity.
Yeah, there's been an abundance of stories, local newspapers running stories about local UFO cases from those files. So there's a lot of education that has gone on.
Yeah, good stuff. So what else is happening?
A lot. So this is a cool story. This is about a conference, a small gathering that's going to go on in Warminster in the UK. And it's the 50th anniversary of a UFO called The Thing. And you know, that doesn't sound like such an exciting story, except for when you read the details of this story. So it's a really interesting case that started in Christmas Day of 1964 when this housewife was walking to church and she heard these strange crackling sounds and stuff like that in the town of Warminster. The news ran it, and it turned out other people had heard it. There were several witnesses that heard this thing, and there was a UFO sighting. And over the next few months especially, there were like hundreds and hundreds of UFO sightings and people hearing this weird sound in Warminster. They even dubbed this this UFO, which they believe that the sounds were coming from, The Thing. And Warminster for years, really up until this day, has been known as a UFO hotspot because of all of this activity. There's been several documentaries that have been made on the whole thing, and it's a really, really interesting case. So the 50th anniversary actually started, you know, pretty much in January because the stories really came out in January of 1965. But it's a really cool case that I wanted to share with you and your listeners because it's worth taking a look at, and there is an interesting photograph that someone took of a UFO during this period of time.
Yes, way back when I had Kevin Goodman on to talk about this. He's a great guy. And
oh, cool.
Unfortunately, now that I have the show and the evening, it's just too late for me to have guests on from, you know, the UK and Europe. But Kevin Goodman was a big researcher in that.
Yeah, I'll have to talk to him because that's right. And I talk about him in this story. He's the one who's putting on this conference, actually. And I would love to talk to him and because it is a great case. I really like it.
I will sell you his contact information.
Perfect.
Good.
Yeah. Cheap, you shyster. Okay. All right. Another really cool one is I love this one. We've talked about this before, the Buckingham Center for Astrobiology. It's this group of astrobiologists at the universities of Buckingham and Sheffield in England. They also work with the University of Alabama and some other astrobiologists on this side. But these are some scientists who believe they have several examples of microbial life, essentially, found in meteorites, mostly from Mars. So these guys are convinced they've already found extraterrestrial life. What's interesting is one of them, the team lead, has been talking to Astrobiology magazine about this orb, this metallic orb that they found. They sent a balloon up into the stratosphere, and we talked about this a couple months ago.
Right.
And this balloon opened up and grabbed some material from the stratosphere and closed up. And then they examined it, and they found something called the Dragon Particle, which is, they believe, is a microbe from space, probably even something that floats in space, kind of like bacteria floating around in space, you know. There have been studies to show that bacteria can survive in space, so it's possible. And this is just one of the extraterrestrial evidence that they feel they have. However, the balloon, when they examined it, had a little metallic orb the size of a hair that they that made an impact that they believe was from space as well. It has biological filaments on the outside of it, and on the inside, they say it's it has a gooey biological material that is oozing out of it. And you can see this microscope picture that I've put up there, and you can see this oozing material coming out of it. And they feel that not only is this further evidence of life from space, but they also feel that this orb could have been something called direct panspermia. So panspermia is something this group kind of one of the scientists of this group coined the phrase, which is the idea that life is abundant and it travels on meteorites and comets and kind of rains down on the planet, and that's how life came here from elsewhere. But directed panspermia is ET civilizations directly seeding life on other planets, kind of like the movie Prometheus. So they're saying this orb could have been sent here to seed life or viruses or something like that. They admit it would be difficult, if not impossible, to prove it, but it is a theory that they're putting out there. But here again, this group's belief they've found even more evidence of extraterrestrial life.
Amazing. Just like Jason said, this is going to be the year. I really think it is.
Yeah, it may be the year. And you know what's cool about this too is that even though they're kind of considered they are legitimate scientists, but they are considered a little fringe. However, NASA is repeating their study. NASA is going to also send a balloon into the stratosphere to see if it can get microbes as well.
Well, that's real exciting news.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we have another story? Is that it?
No, that's not it, buddy. Speaking of exciting news, there's more. Now, these are both Roswell stories. This first one is not as exciting. This is really regarding a video that a Australian New Zealand magazine called Uncensored has released that they say is they're the first ones to have this, and they've been able to prove that this video shows a Roswell alien being collected by the Air Force.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's not a new video. It's actually been around for many, many years. It's part of the Roswell dissection autopsy alien video that was out in the mid-90s that has since been debunked, where the guy Ray Santilli says, oh yeah, well that isn't real, but I did see a real video and I made this to look like the real video. It also, this clip in particular, which is, you know, the best produced clip because there's more actors kind of running around, and it is a very well produced little clip that looks legitimate. It was actually also part of a movie called Alien Autopsy, where these comedians kind of did a movie that kind of mirrored what really happened there and what would you do if you had real alien video kind of thing. But this is just a rehash of some old stuff. These guys, for some reason, I guess just for marketing purposes, are saying that it's the first time it's been out there. Maybe they don't know. Maybe they were told that by whoever gave it to them. But with a little bit of research, they could have found that this video has been out for a while. However, new evidence of Roswell aliens and photographs of Roswell aliens was promised to be released by a man named Tom Carey, who in November told American University in a panel, you know, with Leslie Kane and some other UFO researchers, that he had the smoking gun. He had photos of an alien, but he couldn't show them yet. Well, he has coupled up with, you know, his research partner is Don Schmidt, but he has partnered up. They have partnered up with Jaime Musan, and Jaime Musan announced today in an online press conference that May 5th at the National Auditorium in Mexico City. They're going to release these pictures and show them to the world. And they told us a lot. They showed a lot of pictures in some videos that they posted on YouTube today as part of this press conference and gave a lot more information about these photographs. Essentially, there was a woman who was cleaning up a home of this deceased couple, and she found a box of photographs, and they were preparing it for an estate sale. These were part of the things they wanted her to throw away, but she decided to keep them. This is 1989. 10 years later, she picks up the box, and she looks, and she sees pictures of Dwight Eisenhower, Clark Gable, some famous people, and she thinks, wow, these are really cool. Well, the bottom of the box is, you know, damaged by water. It starts to fall apart. She sees that there are some slides that are wrapped up carefully, opens them up, and there's two slides there that look like an alien. A friend of the family said he saw them, and he said, yeah, that she, you know, if you look at them, most people say, hey, those are aliens because they look like what we think aliens look like. This thing's dissected. Its head is off of itself. But there's been some analysis to show these pictures do come from 1947 or around there. The sleeve comes from the time period. So they believe these pictures legitimately were from that period of time. And that's about really as far as we get with analysis. So they believe them to be legitimate real aliens, and they're thinking because it's from 1947, these got to be the Roswell aliens. I guess it looks like this thing's laying on an army cot or an army blanket. But, yeah, so the pictures will be shown in May, and then my story that I'm still preparing, but we'll have posted, hopefully, you know, by the time people click on the link on your page, there's even pictures of kind of an animation of what the alien would have looked like.
Wow. Yes, please do make sure you send that link after you get the story done.
Will do. So do you want to hear about another story I'm working on? By the time news is so okay. Quick, by the time next week comes around, it'll be old news.
All right, sure.
But yeah, I'm just working on this other video that Stephen Greer has released from CSETI. He charges people $2,500 to go out, and he teaches people how to communicate with aliens and to call in UFOs. They've got a photograph of what they say is an alien. Unfortunately, really, this thing looks like a blob to me. I don't see it whatsoever. But they feel that they were visited by an alien. You know, nobody saw it with their eyes, but it was captured on a camera. But this recent video he just posted like yesterday or the day before shows these two bright objects out over the ocean, and they're at Vero Beach in Florida. Well, just for people, I mean, I've heard from someone else who's a witness who said he saw some flying discs, but to me they looked like flares because they appear and then they fall slowly even to the right, and then they fade out, which is exactly what a flare would do. So far, the experts I have spoken with have agreed with that. They've independently, I didn't tell them what I thought it was. I was just like, what do you guys think? And Mark D'Antonio in particular pointed out some good things to show that, you know, definitely flares. So that's what it appears to be. So when your readers, listeners see those videos, they can determine for themselves. But at least thus far, from the experts, that's what I'm hearing.
Wow. I wonder if Stephen put the little Atacama baby, you know, on a little parachute in one of the flares.
Yeah, he was so upset with it and blew it up.
Yeah, he might have done that. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't even think of that.
Hey, well, that's it finally, right?
That is finally it, my friend. A lot of news. And luckily for you, I'm busy with the conference, so you're getting a lot of the news even before we have it posted.
Well, great. So make sure you send those links. And the listeners out there, you can check out podcastufo.com in the show notes and links to all those stories and videos and all that. So thank you very much, Alejandro, and we'll be talking to you next week.
My pleasure. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
All right. So stay tuned. We have a little music break, and then we're coming back with Jesse Marcel III. Welcome to the show, Jesse.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for offering to be a guest. We have a couple things to talk about here tonight. First of all, I want to say to the live listener, if you're listening live, please jump over to the chat room and join in. That's at podcastufo.com, and it's just two clicks to get in. Jesse, we're going to be talking about your new venture, which is, I think, really exciting. I don't know a lot about flying cars, but I've always been intrigued by them. And I remember watching videos back in the, I want to say the 70s or 60s. But anyway, the second hour, we're going to be talking about Roswell, your family connection, stuff like that.
Sure.
So for someone who has not heard you before, can you just give a real, you know, short in the nutshell type of explanation of who you are, your family connection, and then we'll get into your car.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Well, like you said, my name is Jesse Marcel, actually Jesse Marcel III. I am the grandson of Major Marcel, who was one of the lead investigators into the Roswell incident. Grew up in Montana, where with my father, Dr. Marcel, who also was part of the story, of course, and spent summers in Louisiana, some of the earlier days, down at Grandpa's house in Atahoma, Louisiana. And it was through this adventure and the communications that I learned about Roswell and was kind of one of the people that the story was handed down to.
Right.
In a nutshell.
That was really good. Brief. Yeah. Yeah. And we had you on the show a while back. And,
yes.
And it was really nice talking. And, you know, we lost your father last year. I should say you lost your father.
Yeah, so we really miss him.
Yeah, I bet you do. He seemed like such an awesome man, really.
Yeah, you know, he was one of those people that he added a lot of credibility to the ufology and the study and the stories behind Roswell. He was a medical doctor, a colonel in the military, and, you know, his story of his experiences never varied from what he saw as a child. Excuse me, as a child, and you culminate that into a medical doctor, a physician, who is an avid astronomer and physicist, also. But anyway, yes, that was kind of his background.
Yeah, yeah. Now let's talk about your brainchild here. Is it your idea, this airborne motors?
Yeah, it's a. Draws out too long. As a child, my dad would bring in me and my brother over to somewhere called the Holter Laboratories. They were located in Helena, Montana, where we grew up. This gentleman, Norman Holter, he invented the Holter monitor, that kind of thing, and happened to be, or Jeff Holter, excuse me, was a good friend of the family's, and he had, in his laboratory, he had, it was like four floors. One was nothing but physics, one was chemistry, one was biology, and one was just kind of crazy, everything put together. So I grew up in this atmosphere of basically studying, testing, physics, all that kind of thing, and my dad really ingrained with us as kids that it was important for us to grasp the ideas out there, or to come to our conclusions, do our own testing, etc., for different ideas that we might have. And we had the luxury of that laboratory. As a small example, I think on the top floor he had jars and jars of different chemicals, and one of those was basically powdered zinc and sulfur, and you mix them together in the right combination, you mix great rocket fuel. So that is what me and my brother started doing, was making rocket fuels when we were kids, and, you know, causing trouble with it, few fires in the garage, that kind of thing. Anyway, going up till now in the last few years, I just, you know, there's some ideas out there for flying cars. The real name, or the true name, or more proper name, would be a personal air vehicle. It was actually created by NASA, that terminology, anyway, in the last 20 years. And what's out there is airplanes with folding wings can be driven on the highway, helicopters on wheels. There are a couple of other attempts out there that have been going on for decades, really, to try to create some kind of a stable vehicle, and they just haven't had that much luck with it. But I came up with this new concept, and that's where it's based on a gyroscope. It's a flying car that has a hybrid rotor that it creates stability, creates thrust, the body of the vehicle actually creates a magnetic field around the rotor that creates causes the rotor to spin, basically. Other than that, if you take that component out of it, it's like a giant quadcopter. So you put those two elements together, and that's what it is. I've been working on it for a while now. We have 3D printed models, gone into prototyping the computer systems to keep it stable, that kind of thing. So that's kind of where it's at right now.
Now, isn't there? It seems to me I watched a documentary. I don't know, maybe a year or two ago, about a guy that has something with rotary engines, four separate rotary engines. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, very familiar. It's been around for like 30-something years, and I don't want to talk out of character. I'm not familiar with the project other than what I've read on the internet, and I've looked at the patents for it and that kind of thing to see how it operated. It's actually fairly simple. It's based on technology that's been around for decades, and I think they're trying to evolve it and make it more of a computer, some kind of computer system to control the thrust vectoring of the turbines to try to make it stable.
Uh-huh. And the difference with yours is you have the centrifugal wheel, basically. I mean, the gyroscope.
Right. It's a hybridization of technologies that create a stable aircraft or a personal air vehicle. So it is different. By using the technology that I have applied to this, I'm not by no means the inventor of this technology. I'm just applying it to this car. It creates something that's very compact, that can fit in your garage, very easy to fly. Going through the numbers, basically, it could be autonomously controlled, from no different than a quadcopter. You control from an iPhone if it was, a drone, so to speak. But extremely stable. If you were to fly it yourself and it was to get out of control, you just let go of all the controls, and it would immediately right itself into a solid hover.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea behind it is creating the most stable, stable vehicle possible that's easy to fly, easy to drive. It uses a steering wheel and pedals. It drives just like a regular car.
Now,
Except,
do you have your pilot's license? Do you fly?
No, I do not.
Uh-huh. So this is just something you had an interest in somehow? Your father flew, right?
He was a helicopter pilot.
Ah,
He didn't fly fixed wings, but he was a part of an attack battalion. Although some of the processes that are used in the helicopters is used in this. But I used to be a wildland firefighter, and I was part of a heli-attack team where the closest I've ever been is riding on Huey helicopters to go to the fronts of different fires, forest fires, that kind of thing. But I was an average RC modeler.
Mm-hmm.
And really became interested in it when we had electric motors and batteries capable of, lightweight lithium ion kind of things, capable of powering these things. And the same thing about this, the Typhoon, I've called it, is it's completely electric.
We just had a question up in the chat room asking that. So it's electric.
Completely electric. There's some very large advantages to being electric. One is that you create 100% of the torque available to you the instant the motor starts turning.
Hmm.
So you can have a design of a rotor to make it as obviously we want to make it so it can actually fly in and out of your garage. You pull in a driveway and take off. Hmm. It needs to be as quiet as possible. You can't have something that's going to be sounding like a jet taking off in your neighborhood. You can create an immense amount of torque instantly through an electric motor. The way it is right now, you can by having a rotor that has steep enough that the actual fins inside of it create the thrust. It doesn't have to spin as fast as like a propeller would to create the same thrust. So you can turn something that's going to take a lot of force because of its sheer size. It's about 10 feet in diameter. But with a torque, electricity does it well. And another component of being electric is that it's fully manageable. You can raise and lower the revolutions per minute, the RPMs of the rotor very easily and very incrementally. In series of 10 RPMs, 20, 30, 1,000, 1,000, 10, 1,000, 20, that kind of thing. And when you're talking about a gas-powered turbine, it's not going to be as nearly controllable. When you raise and lower the RPMs in a gas motor, you don't have the kind of flexibility, you don't have the kind of control you would with an electric motor.
right. I know of an investor you ought to get the word to. How about Elon Musk?
Yeah, it's with the Tesla and and SpaceX and that kind of thing. You're not the first person to say that. I have a business partner who we do movies with, and he just bought the latest Tesla D and that kind of thing, and he's a huge Elon Musk fan. And that is that's a possibility, right? We're in the middle. When we talked a couple weeks ago, I was in the middle of doing an Indiegogo campaign, you know, putting together and massaging it, ready to go out there and seeing about doing a little bit of crowdfunding, and just basically to get it from the prototype stage into something that could be tested, a manned pilot kind of thing. And in the thrust of that, I have some friends who are they do some extreme television for, I don't want to mention their name, but one of the larger power drink companies. Mm-hmm. And in this meeting, they were talking about the latest a series of shows that they'd like to produce with them. It involves everything from airplanes to race car, that kind of thing. And somewhere in there, I'd sent them over a little one-page data sheet with a couple of photos on it, and the VP grabbed it, looked at it, ended the meeting, and now wants to present to the president of the company because they've been looking at this, and this just what I've created is exactly what they're looking for. So it's kind of put a kind of an interesting position. They'd be great if they wanted to come along and back it. So we're kind of waiting to see how that goes.
I think I know the company, and they have a bunch of helicopters themselves.
Yes, they have all high technology. They're very much into all the extreme stuff.
Yes,
but it's
and
exciting.
Like snowboarding and.
They went literally from, it's a very large company. You have all these layers you need to go through, and he's willing to bypass everything and jump right to the president.
Wow.
And so it's good. I've pulled back. I'm not quite sure if I'm going to do the Indiegogo campaign, but I think I'm going to go out. I'm in the middle of assembling the paperwork to do basically a small private offering. So I think I'm going to start there. And if this other company comes along, then great. That'll knock. Obviously. Getting funds for this kind of thing is one of the difficult early stages you go through. So I would resolve that. But at this point, it's full steam ahead. So,
wow, exciting. Now, the one thing that I thought of when you were talking about electric, it seems to me that the weight of the batteries would be detrimental to this. Am I not thinking correctly?
You are thinking correctly. Now, if you look at that photo I sent you, it's based – I call it the Typhoon F1. It's not too tricky. F stands for freedom. One stands for one passenger. The rotor itself is – I figure it's a large electric motor, very large, 10 feet in diameter. It's possible to put – for that rotor to actually – with the magnetic fields are created within the actual craft itself and within the magnetic rotor itself, you can create between 3,000 and 4,000 horsepower. And with that, you could create an immense, the thrust would be no problem, even if the batteries weighed 35 to 40% of the entire vehicle with the occupant. Now, you don't want to create a vehicle that has to create that much thrust for liftoff. So you're kind of in a quandary. It's like, okay, the longer the flight time, the more batteries you have. So is it better for your test vehicles to maybe have a shorter flight time and have less weight in batteries? Now we're looking at fuel cell technology also, and it's already out there. So we'll probably be moving to fuel cells, in the next 24 months when we're actually in production, we'll probably be more fuel cell powered, and that will relieve some of that weight issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess one of the questions that one would think of is safety.
Mm-hmm.
How would you address safety on something like this?
Well, it's interesting. I'm working with two folks who are both astronauts, and one of them worked on the Mars lander and those projects. And what they did that was one of the things we were talking about is a safety. How do we do this? And there is apparently something similar to an airbag that's on the bottom of these crafts that they're working on. And we're going to apply that same technology. So you almost have a giant airbag under the bottom of it and a rocket-propelled chute.
Hmm.
So you have two methods. And the another thing is, it's – this wouldn't have any, you know, it could fly 25,000 feet. That's not an issue. But ideally, you're going to fly at about 25, 35 feet off the ground. You're not going to want to fly up into the clouds, that kind of thing. It's to make it useful, like I said, you could do that, but part of the idea is to make it so that you're not, you know, you're basically just flying over the power lines.
Interesting. Boy, there's been many times, I'm sure, a lot of listeners, as well as myself, wish we had one when we're stuck in traffic. Just pop right over a bunch of cars. Now, what has stopped other people from succeeding, trying to do a similar thing to what you're doing?
Well, you know, nobody's done it the way I've done it. Idea of actually the craft being a gyroscope, it's the first one out there, at least. I mean, we have, you know, provisional patents, and we have a design patent on it now, and a bunch of other things. And you go through and the research, it really just hasn't been done this way before, for one thing. But even bigger than that, we need current technology to make this work. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the density or the energy density in a battery wasn't great enough that this would even been possible. It would have weighed far too much. I mean, you're talking back in, you know, lead acid batteries and that kind of thing. Just really, you couldn't get enough energy out of a battery and put it into your system, your magnetic system, and make it work. So it's really just technology has come far enough now that it's possible.
Now, do you have a engineering background, or is this just something are pursuing in other ways?
No, I when I was in college, I went through aerospace engineering and finance and economics, kind of a strange thing. And I ended up my day job has always been, I was in banking for quite a number of years. And when everything kind of went south in banking, you know, back in 06 and 07, I decided to go out and kind of follow up on the family history, wrote a book about Roswell documentary, and I'd go around doing, you know, a few speeches here and there. And it's kind of, that was done. That was interesting. I've had a lot of fun. I've really had a good experience the whole thing. But in the background has been this fight to get back into the arena of aerospace engineering. So this has given me the ability to really go back into that. I've always been I don't know what you would call it, a designer. If I could spin off a little bit here from the car, the car was supposed to be a test bed for another technology I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
It's it's a quadcopter that has four corner fans that operate quadcopter. Other than they don't provide lift, they provide directional control and that kind of thing. I've been working with, and this is my old. It's based on theoretical physics, a theoretical idea anyway. It's being able to absorb energy in a fluid, being able to divide gravimetric forces, so you create a bias driver, singular vectored. It's kind of funny. You call it inertia. Inertia means static, but if you can picture a ball that wants to be pulled out of your hands, and it's not pushing around the air around it. It's actually internal. And I've done some tests using fluids, and it works. The next thing is to step up and create a mechanized vectored motor that could be used to propel direction. So the idea is actually to apply a non-existent yet, as of yet, technology. Although, I mean, people could be sure talking about it, working on it in some laboratory somewhere in the world I don't know about, of course. But the idea is to create a form of a motor, electric again, that creates this vectored force, and like, for instance, it could be used in an airplane. Instead of using a jet engine or propellers, or you're not pushing air, it creates a vectored momentum with inside the airplane. So it would be perfectly silent, all electric. The force it creates is really it's asymptotic to infinity. It's just some ideas. Those ideas have been with me since I've been in my early 20s. So, like I said, making a long story of this whole thing is I wanted to create a stable aircraft that I could create these motors that are these sources of energy, put them on board, and actually use those to push it around. And so the Typhoon was nothing more than a test bed, but it became more than that. When I put it together, I put together a think tank, and a couple of them are astronauts, really intelligent people that have kind of added their two cents in about some of the mechanisms. And then I started raising eyebrows and decided, well, let's just go about this thing in a big way.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about the car.
Okay.
The Typhoon? Is that what
yes.
you're, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So I have a Typhoon in my garage, and I have it plugged in, most likely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go to work, and I'm going to go through a couple of cities or whatever. So
sure.
Why don't you just walk me through what you envision on how this thing would work?
Well, the easiest way to put it is it's fully computer controlled. It uses servo mechanisms, fly by wire, those kind of things. So you would step into the vehicle. Well, actually, you'd unplug it, of course. Step into the vehicle, and then nothing. Just like the current cars, you'd have a proximity key that would initiate the systems on the car, and there'd be you would propel it or drive it into your driveway, out of the garage in the driveway. It does have a very simple system of wheels. You could drive it out in the driveway. It's not meant to be driven like down the highway on it, but it can be maneuvered with them. And you would push a button that would create an automatic liftoff sequence. So it would measure the weight of the car. It would proximity detectors would make sure there's nothing around it that could possibly be obstructed or impacted when this thing took off. And so you push this button. Once it's figured out the surroundings, it would raise you to a given altitude of about 30 feet. At that point, you would take over and fly it to wherever you're going to go. Either you could have preset the your guide path, your flight path, excuse me, or you would input it through, again, something as simple as steering wheel. Once you're at 30 feet, turn right to go right, left to go left. There's a gas pedal to make you go forward, or brake pedal will stop you. Now, in addition to those, there are paddles. Same thing you use to switch transmission gears on, like in a modern car. And on the paddles, you pull the right paddle, it'll go up. Pull the left paddle, it'll go down. So, obviously, because you're moving in three dimensions. But the whole idea is that the car without your inputs is the most stable. So whenever you add an input, whenever you make a change in direction, you're actually making it a little less stable. And then when you let the car take back the control again, it comes back to be more stable. So it really, once you're at that 30-foot altitude, you're basically pointing and going.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're cutting edge on the edge. There isn't an infrastructure built. There are no rules, that kind of thing, yet for these things. So
I was going to ask about that.
They'll come around. I mean, we're at the front of it, along with some other people. So, the way I envision it is eventually they'll become more and more autonomous, preset corridors that you can fly within.
Mm-hmm.
But like, if you can think about it this way, okay, I'm going to go to work in this thing. I pull out of my garage, I push a button, 30 feet. Okay, I know where I'm going to, and you could do you could have a map show up. It's like on a tablet type screen in front of you. It's going to show you where to go, and it'll, as long as you stay with the little green lines on the glass in front of you, you'll know you're okay to get to where you're going and in the right direction at the right height and that kind of thing. And then a parking garage, I wouldn't think in the new distant future, when these become more the norm, when you become within a certain proximity of that parking structure, be it a quarter mile, a thousand, whatever, a predetermined set figure, it's going to now can take control of the car. You're going to let go of it, and it'll guide your car in. It'll set you down in a space. So you won't really be the one to control bringing in or taking off when there's other, cars or whatever around. It'll all be fairly automatic or autonomous.
Now, would there have to be some type of special licensing?
Right now, as long as it stays under a certain weight, no. And that was part of what we were doing. Now, everything we're doing and working with the FAA on, the idea is once we surpass, I think it's like 1,500 pounds, then it'll move us into a different category for the base weight of the vehicle. But there'll be so we'll be working hand in hand with them. Obviously, at some point, there's going to be some restrictions placed on these sort of vehicles, and you'll have to go through some kind of training school, and it'll be an addendum to your driver's license to be able to use it. Like I said, right now it doesn't exist, but I can't imagine in the not too distant future will be a some kind of mandatory event. Like right now, the FAA will require testing of the vehicle under tether. They'll make you go out and prove that the vehicle can do what it wants to do. Once you've proven that, then you're allowed to untether it. That nobody's gotten that point of being untethered, with the exception there's a there is a thanks made There is one out there that's basically an airplane with folding wings, and they have made it past that. One of the issues is when you deal with an airplane that they can fold down to drive on a road, but that means you're still taking off and landing at an airport. And just because of all the craziness in the world, it's probably going to be more difficult to fly to an airport and drive off, or drive onto an airport and fly out without a lot of checking or a lot of inspections, that kind of thing. And you know, who knows where that'll go. But
yeah, that is almost like they'd almost have to create separate airports just for those.
Exactly, just for safety's sake. Like I said, you know, just theorizing, but it'll be interesting to see. I mean, the world will look completely different in the next 30 years when it comes to this kind of technology. There's some forecasts that came about saying by 2050 this technology will be the norm, and it'll be necessary to navigate large cities and that kind of thing. And it kind of makes sense. You know, I'm doing it for fun. I'm excited by it. It's kind of you've seen a picture of the car. It looks more like a sports car than anything else.
It's quite beautiful. The listener can check out right now, actually. If you're listening live on podcastufo.com, in the show notes, right on the front page, we have a picture of it. It's a great looking, and that's all your design.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. We start with sketches, then went to SolidWorks and made a 3D model of it. That's kind of how we started. So technology is so wonderful now. You can go from scratching on a piece of paper to holding a model within weeks.
I know, it's amazing. The 3D printer you mentioned. That whole thing is amazing. Now, you mentioned earlier, you know, that finances.
Yes.
Are there any other blockers or major hurdles that you're aware of at this point?
You know, this is the way I look at it, is I can, you know, it's not really a finance term. I'll bootstrap it. I'll fund it out of my pocket until it's done. In my mind, there's nothing that's going to stop it from being done. Now, past that, I am going to be looking for some partners. Mm-hmm. To join the company that think, wow, that thing's pretty cool. Let's see what we can do with it. And just to elevate to the point where it's not going to – it won't take me a couple years to get to the point of having this thing ready to go. And, of course, you know, in there is there's – like I said, the other company that's interested in coming along and endorsing it. So we'll see where it goes. But, you know, it's like any new adventure. it's a monetary constraint.
Yeah.
Technology's done, though. I mean, we're using 3D printing to create the mold, to lay up carbon fiber, to create the panels, and that's what it's – the whole thing's almost entirely made of carbon fiber. We already have people ready to lay up everything from the rotor to the body panels to everything's – you know, all that's pretty much ready to go. And like I said, technology's made that a lot easier. You know, my 3D model I have that can fit in your hands, we can take those same called STL files and create the actual real panels from that. So it's pretty amazing.
The one thing I, you know, I could envision, and there may be something you've already thought of about this, is, you know, collisions with other. Let's just say that these become popular.
Yes.
A lot of people have them. You mentioned corridors, which
mm-hmm.
Sounds like a good idea. But you know, the cross, T-boning someone or something like that.
Sure.
All that it would be kind of hard to regulate.
Well, you know, there's. You know, on the level we're talking about right now, it's easy. There are sensors, proximity detectors, that will the computer will not let you get within a certain number of feet, a certain fixed variable you'll create of another object. Say it's 5 feet, 10 feet, 100 feet, whatever that is. So it would actually you could steer yourself right into the side of a building, and it would never let you do that, or into another car and that kind of thing. So it's going to be aware, you know, through avionics, something similar to an airplane. Obviously, it's not a control center, but same way. I think, you know, some of the larger luxury car manufacturers already have, you know, put together these crash avoidance, and a lot of those is the same kind of proximity detection that you could run up on a parked car in front of you, and when it detects you're moving faster than, you know, than the brakes in a meaningful sense will be able to stop you, it'll slam on the brakes for you. So it's that same kind of technology.
I see.
In three dimensions, you know, rather than two.
And what do you envision a speed of something like this could travel?
You know, I was never designed for speed. I mean, of course, since you're talking about being airborne, you have a little more flexibility that way. But you know, really, not the design I have right now, not much different than a car 60 or 80 if you're going to express it in miles per hour. You know, not terrifically fast. Not that you couldn't push it to do that. As an example, the way the car is controlled, the corner rotors. And it might be hard to envision this unless you're seeing a picture of it, are rotatable in three dimensions. So you can stay, the car can stay level and still go and make turns, go forward, go backwards, because the rotors are actually changing the direction. But in another setting with the car, you'd be able to fix the rotors, and then you'd be banking through turns, and instead of going on a level flight, the nose would tip down. And all of a sudden, your main rotor that's creating all the thrust would also give you forward thrust. And it's those kind of things. If you want to get into more of a sporting mode, then really, you know, it's something probably more similar to a small Cessna, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's limitless. Depending on what you – I mean, you could design it to go much faster if that's what you want it to. But
someone on the message board was wondering if you think that you could do stunts with this, loop-de-loops and stuff like that.
Yes, you could do anything. You figure you have complete control in three dimensions, and you can do it statically. You can do it from a single point. So it's not like an airplane or, you know, where you got to get momentum. You got to go forward and get enough energy that you can do a loop or a strong enough motor to hang out the prop, that kind of thing. This could, yes, you know, you could – any of those could be possible in a very small space, actually.
Wow. Now – I would imagine if you had four rotors, no matter – even if you're running off electricity, which is basically very quiet, it would still mm-hmm. cause quite a bit of noise.
You know, because the rotors are big enough and they don't have to turn so fast, so it actually wouldn't be that noisy. Nothing at all compared to like a regular airplane. Mm-hmm. In fact, if it went overhead, say, 30 feet off the ground, you probably couldn't hear it.
Really? So it'd be nothing like a helicopter or anything like that?
No, nothing like that at all. And a lot of the noise made in a helicopter, the rotors, the leading edge of one rotor will catch an air pocket behind the trailing edge, and it causes that clapping sound kind of going through there. Those kind of things, you hear them when they slow down. Just because of the way this is, like I said, the rotor doesn't need to turn nearly as fast as a helicopter does, for instance, and it relegates it. It makes it a lot more quiet. In fact, like I said, it would be. I mean, you'd definitely be able to hear it if it was by you, or immediately in your vicinity. But flying overhead, you really wouldn't notice it.
Now, I know I read somewhere where, you know, the helicopter wouldn't work until they made the rotor tilt or whatever, because it would catch that air pocket and it would crash. And, you know, they had a lot of hit and miss to get that thing going in the beginning.
Yep, there was, like I said, there is, I mean, some of the technology in a helicopter. What's interesting is you figure like a Huey helicopter. They're powered by a couple of turbines. I think they put out like about 785 horsepower each. And they're, they're quite like a Huey helicopter, which I'm fairly familiar with, weigh, you know, quite a bit. Many times what this car does. But yet, because of electricity, you can create almost as much more, actually create more horsepower, if you put it that way. And we're not, you know, you can convert horsepower to watts, but if we stay at the idea of horsepower, you can create more horsepower with what I've done here than in a Huey helicopter, just because of the way the leverage in the motor works, the way it's created within the body of this. So if you create a very strong motor with very steeply angled fins with inside of a rotor, like I said, they don't have to go that fast and create an incredible thrust.
Wow. I might have some listeners, I was just thinking, I might have some listeners complain that this show has nothing to do about UFOs.
Yes, yep. But, I could understand that completely.
So I'm ready for that. But for the listener, we will be talking about that in the second hour some more. Now, have you figured out what a range would be from plug-in to re-plug-in?
You know, it's more like, you know, you should be able to run for about an hour So roughly is why I put it an hour. So you figure, okay, well, if you're going 30 miles an hour, you should be able to go about 30 miles. If you're going 60 miles an hour, about 60 miles. You know, I would say to be safe, when we're actually testing and we get things going, you know, about a 20-mile distance.
I see.
And then go from there. But like I said, we're also at the very beginning of this thing. It could be designed like you create enough thrust to actually have far more, you know, a far bigger power supply in it than I'm going to be putting into it. So it's possible to greatly increase that. But again, you know, for simplicity, for safety, for testing, it's just not going to be as far.
Now, I would think that you'd want to create a miniature prototype of this. Have you thought of that?
You know, I was going to get create a 30% scale model of the whole thing, but by the time you get that far, because of, again, 3D printing, that kind of thing, I mean, if you're, I'm going to be using the same computer, the same mechanical ideas in the prototype as the small scale version, that as a cost, they're so close to the same to build a 30% model as to build a full scale model, that it almost makes sense just to build the full scale model.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it would have been the case, like I said, 10 years ago, completely would have made sense to make a smaller, you know, proof of concept kind of thing. But now it's just, like I said, the differential is so small that it's just, you know, it's about 30% more to get the full version that somebody could sit in and fly. So we're just going to go for it all.
I think of early car manufacturers for some reason when I'm thinking about, you know, how you're plugging along with this idea. You know, it's kind of in the same realm, only it's a different, you know, a whole different animal, but still, would you fear any type of, say, competition? You know, like, for instance, Tucker, when he was building his car, he built the prototype type of thing, same thing, and, you know, but he was basically pushed out of business. So you fear any – do you think there's anything out there that would, like, come at you to stop you from moving ahead?
I mean, as far as that goes, I mean – it's almost better because things move so fast today. It's almost better to get your idea out there and take ownership of it in a big sense. Sometimes trying to keep it obscure with only a few people knowing about it, I think it almost opens you up to competition more. In that, if I get this thing out there, so it's everywhere. I mean, of course, I've covered, you know, with the patents and that kind of thing for how the technology is being applied. But if somebody else goes there and they say, "Oh, that's pretty cool, I'm going to make one too," it comes down to the point where, you know, and maybe I'm a little optimistic that it'd be better for them to contact me and work together on something than it would be to try to take it and do something themselves. Just from the legal liability sense and the rest of it, it's like, you know, I'm not a big greedy person. I'm thinking, oh, hey, if you have something, you say, well, I can get that done in, you know, in 2 months rather than 2 years. You know, let's put something together to get, you know, it doesn't have to be a us versus them kind of thing.
Conversely, are you thinking about anyone that's out there right now that you're thinking about approaching?
You know, I have a couple of names and people, you know, part of it, you know, is leveraging my name. Let's be honest with it. I get out there because of my name with Roswell. I get the chance to meet and talk to a lot of very interesting people, and some of them are fairly powerful and wealthy and that kind of thing. So there is a window of opportunity to talk to some of those folks. So that is definitely a possibility. What I've decided to do is, like I said, I'm going to try to find some partners that'll come along that might, and then look for them to come in at the very beginning and give me a little bit of time, and then, you know, and then walk in, because I have a couple of larger people that I could definitely sit down and talk to, but I want to be completely put together when I do that.
Yeah. All right. Can you give out? We're just about at the end of the first hour here. Can you give out your website and Facebook page, Twitter, all that stuff?
Yeah, it's airbornemotors.com, airborne with an E, AIRBORNE, motors.com. There's also a Twitter feed, which is airborne. Facebook, if you just go to Jesse Marcel, you'll find it on Facebook. You'll see my father's, you'll see mine, and I think there's a couple other ones. I think I'm actually the third one on there or something like that. But if you just look Jesse Marcel, you'll see my smiling face. That's one of the easy ways to get to it.
Yeah, okay. Well, all right, so why don't you say goodbye to the first hour listeners?
thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope I didn't bore you.
No, I think it's been fascinating. And it's the second hour we're going to be talking about your family, Roswell, and something I sent you a clip of to see what you thought about that. Well, that's it for the show. If you're listening live, hang in there for the second part of the show. We're going to be talking with Jesse Marcel III about Roswell and more. And so if you're listening as a podcast, remember to subscribe for just $1 a month to hear the entire show. You can go on getjoyride.com/podcastUFO, and all the information is right there. I want to thank some people for helping out with the show today. Our guests, of course, Jesse Marcel III. I also want to thank Alejandro Rojas for the UFO news, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Robert Davis, PhD, will be talking to us next week about his new book entitled The UFO Phenomena, Should I Believe? That's with a question mark. You can check us out next week on the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis saying keep your eyes to the sky.